Okay, good. So we're going on to a new theme at the Monday class for about the next 10 weeks. And that theme is it's the teachings of Milarepa. The theme really is this book called The Yogi's Joy by Sangharakshita. The Yogi's Joy is themed around this figure of Milarepa, who I'm going to be saying a little bit about now. And then we're going to be exploring various teachings that sort of are sparked off by this. So here's Milarepa on the shrine. It's quite a small picture, but hopefully you can get a little glimpse so you can come forward later and have a look. And the prayer flags are kind of in honour of him because they're Tibetan and he is Tibetan. Do come in. So Milarepa lived just over 1,000 years ago. He's meant to live from 1040 to 1123 and lived in Tibet. And the image of him is the same one, is more or less the same. And he's always depicted as an ascetic. What signifies he's an ascetic is he's naked. So he's naked apart from this white loincloth, which those of us that were here for the first half heard blew away in the storm, leaving him completely naked. And he's got the red meditation sash band. And he sits cross-legged and he lives in a cave in the snowy mountains of Tibet. And he looks quite white in this picture, but actually he was green. I put him on a green cloth to sort of represent that he was green. And the reason that he was green was that all he subsided on was nettles. When he lived in this cave, he just ate nettle soup and drank nettle tea. So he was definitely an ascetic. But although he was an ascetic, he certainly wasn't. There was no feeling of hard done by in him. He's got his hand cupped like this to show that all the time he was singing. When he wasn't meditating, he was singing, joyfully singing his teaching. So his songs are full of joy, and that the book on the shrine is one of the volumes of the 100,000 songs of Milarepa. There's not literally 100,000, but there's quite a lot. And there's two whole volumes of his songs, and they're full of joy. And he sings to everyone, human beings, and also gods and goddesses and demons, and in all sorts of conditions, whatever condition they're in. And his songs are very rich in imagery, and they've also got quite a touch of humour about them. In some ways they sound simple, but in that what they're also doing is touching on the deepest truths of the Dharma, these songs. So I'm going to say just a little bit about his life story, just a tiny bit. He's got a very interesting life story. He wasn't always an ascetic and wasn't always a Dharma practitioner. What happened, he was living in a family and his father died and the uncle and aunt cheated Milarepa and his family out of their inheritance. And so then Milarepa, at the instigation of his mother, learned black magic and apparently destroyed 36 of his family's enemies by magic. But then he repented of that and he found his way to Marpa, the translator, who was his teacher, and he became Marpa's disciple. There's quite a teaching in that itself, which is that nobody could ever be so bad that they can't find the Dharma. So even though he's apparently murdered 37 people who 36 people. It's not that he's kind of forever damned or anything like that. He becomes a disciple of Marpa. And Marpa himself was a disciple of another Indian tantric sage, Naropa, who himself was a disciple of Tilopa, and he apparently had instruction directly from a Buddha called Vajradhara. And yeah, they would all have taught orally. So these Marpa and all the sort of gurus of his ilk were noted for their severity. So they were very tough on their disciples. And you can see the toughness of Marpa as something that Milarepa had to go through to become purified and make his mind fit for the tantric initiation. So he had to go through, if you read the whole life story, he has to go through all these various trials and tribulations. But eventually he comes to the end of that, all the trials and tribulations, and he is full of faith and energy, intelligence and compassion. And then another episode of the story is Milarepa goes back to visit his birthplace, and there he finds the house in ruins, the sacred books all soaked in rain and covered in dust, and most kind of poignantly, a heap of what he thinks is kind of rags and weeds, but this proves to be the bones of his own mother who's died. And this kind of shocks him. It sort of makes him see that actually, well, it sort of just makes him want to renounce the whole world, that he resolves to spend the rest of his life meditating in solitude. And this is what he does. This is how we see him here in the snows of the Himalayas, just meditating, deepening his insight into the Dharma, and yet teaching through these songs. And there's something that I think really, I think very significant about teaching through songs and poetry. I've just been on retreat myself, and on the retreat myself I was just starting to reflect more and more that as we deepen our Dharma practice, the expression of that will become more poetic. Like, poetry is the closest way to describe what will happen to our Dharma practice as it deepens. At first we might have to start off with perhaps it won't feel like that so much at first. It'll feel like more of an effort in a particular way. But as it starts to take on a life of its own, and in the way that song and poetry does, doesn't it? They start to take on a life of their own. You might start off writing a poem or trying to do anything artistic, and at the beginning there's a sort of effort, isn't it? You've got to get down to it, and you don't always feel like it, and you think of a million other things you'd rather do. But actually, as you get into it, I don't know if you get that, if you have tried painting or writing, then it starts to take on its own life. It's as if it takes over, and your job's more to get out of the way. And I was thinking that's what ideally our Dharma life will more and more become. Something that takes on a life of its own, something that in a sense we can't help but do. It's kind of doing us in a way rather than us doing it. So I was thinking about that quite a lot on my own retreat, and I thought, oh yes, it seems very appropriate that the Dharma would be taught through poetry and song. And that's exactly what Milarepa does. And you get the same thing, same sort of thing in the like the Japanese hermits. Like, you might have heard of Ryokan, a poet hermit, who again teaches through poetry and lives as a hermit. And yeah, so luckily we've got the songs of Milarepa, these not literal 100,000, but many songs of Milarepa. And interestingly enough, our own teacher, Sangharajita, who also actually, interestingly enough, writes a lot of poetry himself, he apparently has given more seminars on the Songs of Milarepa than on anything else. And during the 70s and 80s, Sangha Rajta held a whole bunch of seminars on these songs. And he says that, this is what Sangha Rajta himself says, he says, the seminars took place in a retreat centre in Norfolk, England. He says, in the course of each one of them, we were swept in imagination from the flat East Anglian countryside to the awe-inspiring scenery of Tibet with its towering snow-capped peaks, its deep sunless ravines, and its pleasant flower-carpeted upland valleys. There we heard the clear voice of Milarepa singing his timeless songs. He sang to us as he sung to the men and women of his own day on the joy of living without possessions, the joy of meditating in solitude, the joy of uncompromising commitment to the realization of the highest spiritual ideal. So again, you've got this emphasis on the joy. You don't normally think of that as renunciation, something joyful, but here you've got Milarepa saying of the joy of living without possessions. And what Sangha Rajta says, and he said this a good few years ago, so it'd be even more true now, he says, in these days of consumerism, the mass media and materialistic values, the world needs more than ever to listen to the voice of Milarepa and take the message of his songs to heart. And he says, it's my sincere hope that this book, that's the transcript, sort of, not as transcription of the seminars, but drawn from these seminars, may be a means of making that message more widely known. So I love this book actually. Really recommend this if you're interested. This is on sale in the bookshop. And very, very exciting book actually to read. So I recommend that. So that's a wee bit about Milarepa in general. And as I say, over the next 10 weeks or so, we're going to be going into different episodes more and more deeply. So what I want to emphasise tonight is this whole aspect of Milarepa as the hermit. And what I'm going to talk about is, well, in a way, how can we bring this into our own lives? Here we are, probably all living in the city, I imagine, given that we're here. But how can we, and why would we even bring this aspect of sort of hermitage into our own lives? So what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the evening, and hopefully there'll be chance for discussion and questions and answers, is the practice of solitary retreats. I've got another book to recommend to you, Solitude and Loneliness by Sarbananda. That's a lovely little book. I mean, it's great mention of Charlie Chaplin in this book as the kind of epitomising that existential aloneness. So very, very delightfully written books. I recommend that. So what is a solitary retreat? I'm going to tell you what my understanding of a solitary retreat is. Well, not my practice of solitary retreats, I should say. Well, my understanding of practice is probably slightly different, or even quite a big bit different from different people. So I've been practicing going on solitary retreat about once a year for about the last probably about 25 years or so. So it's become very important to me to do that. And I've not gone, some people go on quite long solitary retreats. If you do pick up that copy of the newsletter, there's an interview with one of the order members who's just left the LBC, Nagarajta, who's just gone on a 9-month solitary retreat. And people have been on even longer. So the longest time I've been is 1 month. A couple of times I've been 1 month, and often I go for a couple of weeks solitary retreat every year. I definitely feel I've missed out if I haven't had those couple of years solitary retreat every year. So I'll say a little bit more, but by the way, just to say at the beginning, I know that people's circumstances mean that that's not possible for everybody to do. But as I speak, we can take the principles of what I say, even if you literally, you know, if your life circumstances would make that not possible, you can still take the principles. So for me, a solitary retreat means going somewhere as secluded as possible. So I often go to, often if I find somewhere I really like, I just keep going back, partly because, you know, just for practicalities, but also I think you probably find this yourself going on any retreat, that you start to build up a connection with a place you go to, so that if you repeatedly go back, the atmosphere of that is more and more in your psyche. And I find that, well, it works both ways. The atmosphere of places I've been on solitary retreat often comes into my dreams, for example. It comes to symbolise meditation to me in my dreams, and so on. So I, for me, going on solitary retreat means going somewhere as remote as possible. And for me, it means going somewhere and sort of staying there, not sort of going out. So that means taking all my supplies with me. Everybody doesn't do it like this, but I really like that. I'll say why a bit later. So for me, it means taking all my supplies with me, and well, that in itself is quite interesting, because then you've got to be a bit, maybe not as, I certainly don't live on nettles, but maybe a little bit more frugal than I would be normally. If I know I'm going to have to carry all this, I don't have a car either, so if I know I'm going to carry all this stuff in my own rucksack, you know, I've got to just not, don't go overboard on the biscuits or something, yeah. So for that's what I do, and for so for me, it's an important aspect of it is not to break it by going out. It would be for me, it would be breaking it if I went out of the kind of sort of charm circle of the solitary retreat. And for me, it definitely means no phone or no internet, and even really, I don't really. Occasionally I've taken recordings of maybe a Dharma talk, but more recently I've thought that that feels, that sort of lessens the solitude, so I've stopped doing that, so I don't have another voice in a way. I do take Dharma books and poetry to read. So that's what it means to me in terms of the practicalities. And yeah, going on solitary retreat is a very traditional practice. So the Buddha himself talked about this. He talked about, there's one discourse where he talks about conditions of strengthening the Sangha. And he talks about this, a condition being for the Sangha to meet in large numbers and go on retreat together. But in the same text, he also talks about encouraging people to go on to meditate in solitude at the roots of trees and so on. So the Buddha, it's a tradition going right back to the Buddha. And it's a tradition in our tradition, in Tri Ratna, solitary retreats have always been part of our tradition. So people have always gone on solitary retreats. And they're a very important part of ordination training, for example, and in our movement. So if someone's training for ordination as well as, you know, there's certain retreats at retreat centres that people are usually expected to go on. Going on solitary retreat is also part of that training. So I thought I'd just try and think for myself anyway, why is it so? Why is it important? Why have we made it part of our Tri Ratna tradition so strongly? So yeah, so I think for me, solitary retreats have definitely got an element of initiation about them. There's an element of even is ordeal the right word? I mean that in a positive way, a sort of testing, a testing of one's mettle, I find, going on solitary retreat. It's a sort of test on one's strength, on every level really. And as I say, I enjoy that. So I am often up the ante of that a bit. Some people do this far more testingly than me. I know one order member who does the solitary retreats and some mountain where he hasn't told anyone where it is, so he just goes up and nobody knows where he is. And I think he has to be very frugal food-wise. I think I heard he had to throw his tea bags away when he realised he didn't have enough sticks to light to boil his water, so he just threw the tea bags away. So I'm not nearly that, I don't stretch to that level. But I try and up the ante a little bit, and as I say, you know, it's a practice for me to just take as much food as I can carry on my own back, for example, and to be quite strict with myself about not being in contact. I think what it does, being on a solitary retreat like that, is that the main thing, whatever one does on solitary retreat, the main thing about it is you're on your own. You're on your own. So I think what this is confronting you with, even before you even think about what you might do, whether you're going to meditate or do a Dharma study or go for walks or sing or whatever, is that you're confronted with your aloneness. And there's a truth in that. There's a truth in that because we are alone. Existentially, we are alone. There's some things that we're going to have to do alone, like die, for example. You know, we can't buffer ourselves from that forever, the fact that we will at some points have to be alone. So going on solitary retreat is, well, perhaps it's getting, I don't know about getting used to that, but it's starting to, well, become sort of conversant with what happens to us, what happens to me when I'm on my own. It's very interesting what happens when you're on your own. It's not always what you think might happen. And that's not always comfortable. It's not always comfortable. I find solitary retreats a really joyful, happy thing to do. Most of my time, I find that I'm very happy on solitary retreats. I'm quite a childlike way. It reminds me of being a little child when I just used to play in the garden quite contentedly. I feel like I enter that mode quite strongly on solitary retreats. But it's possible to feel a lot of fear on solitary retreats, and some people I've heard feel that strongly. I only once felt that. It was just before I got ordained, which I'm sure was no coincidence. And it definitely was no coincidence, because on that solitary retreat, I was in one of the least secluded places I'd ever been. I was kind of on a little road. You know, there was less, I was less alone, but more afraid in a way. And I'm convinced it was the upcoming ordination and the sort of dharmic step of that. I remember having a lot of fear on that retreat. And I tried to practice this teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha felt fear when he was alone. And how he practiced was he just kept doing whatever he was doing. He said, if I feel fear when I'm walking, I just keep walking. If I feel fear when I'm lying down, I just keep lying down. So that was how I tried to practice with the fear. So I feel fortunate that so far I haven't, well, maybe fortunate or unfortunate, I don't know, perhaps it's good to feel fear. Anyway, it's a fact that I haven't felt, so fear hasn't been something that's assailed me personally particularly, although I was interested to notice on this retreat I've just been on, oh, that's the other thing, there's no electric light in the place I usually go, which I also quite enjoy because it means, well, you're just in the rhythm of the daylight. Anyway, I did definitely notice as dusk started to fall, it wasn't so much, I think there was a sort of unease. It wasn't fear. I don't know what it was, but there was an unease, you know, there's a slight, oh, I wonder what would come crawling out, you know, sort of, slight unease. And then in the morning there'd be a relief, oh, it's light again. So I was getting quite interested in what was happening to my psyche as it drew dark. I think all these things are quite interesting, I find. So one certainly got to face one's existential aloneness. You have to rely on your own reserves on a solitary retreat, on your own resources, on all levels, the emotional level, the spiritual or dharma level, even the practical level. It's just quite interesting to notice, well, what happens if something practically, you know, where I might turn to someone else, thinking, oh, well, I have to just sort this now. At one point, I was convinced there was some sort of loch monster. I was near a loch living in the toilet. The toilet was making all sorts of spontaneous gurgles. And I was thinking, oh, God, what was in that toilet? And I just thought, well, you're just going to have to, whatever it is, you're just going to have to deal with it. Anyway, I never saw anything. And I remembered someone who became a mitra recently, Sophie. She wrote on her little sheet of paper we put up on the wall, she said that going on a solitary retreat was where her, over the 4 years she'd been practicing, was where her Dharma practice gathered momentum particularly. She said there was 2 points in those 4 years, and the first was on a solitary retreat. I'll just tell you what she said. She said, the first was a slightly daunting realization within the first hour of solitary retreat that it was only by my own effort that this retreat would actually happen. No bells, no rota, no joke. She says, just me in practice for a whole week. And she says, my retreat survival skills kicked in. I meditated, body scanned, pooja'd, read, stared into space. Kissed trees, she said, I felt outside my comfort zone. Interesting, from dusk I was gripped with fear and morbid thoughts. Something in me felt scared, doubtful, self-conscious, irritable, fake, and a little bit silly. Another part emerged, more grounded, healthy, whole, sure, capable, and wagging its tail. She said, this is hard sometimes, but worth it. Actually, that's quite a good description, isn't it, what she's written? And that there's the test in there. Her resources were tested. There was that realisation, this is down to me, and she did it, you know. And then there's a fruit from that. It's not always easy, but there's a fruit from that. And I definitely felt that myself. There was one day, I just felt really sad, you know. I just felt really sad. And I said, I couldn't stop crying. I was crying. And every time I do it, I just start crying. And I was just thinking, oh, I could just ring my friend. Oh, I could just ring my boyfriend. You know, and I could feel the pull to just want someone. I don't know exactly what I wanted them to do, but I just thought, I wanted just comfort in a way. But I didn't do that. And it was fine, actually. You know, it just sort of, you know, you realise, oh, it just washes through you. It's okay, you know, I'm all right. And I think that's strengthening. I think that you kind of think, oh, yeah, I can be my resource, you know, I can be my resource. So I think, yes, it teaches you to rely on it. In a way, it kind of, it makes you rely on your own resources. I think that what I love about solitary retreats is a certain freedom, and it's particularly, I find, the freedom from having to present yourself in any fashion. That is why I don't want to go to any shops or anything or see anybody, because I don't want to brush my hair, I don't want to wash my face, I don't want to do that. I don't know, I don't know if women do this more than men, that sort of checking, like, am I all right to be seen, am I all right to be out? You see, sometimes you can see people do this even on the street. Actually, I'm thinking of one of those funny seaside postcards I saw once where, you know, there's a kind of rather overweight couple or man and woman, but then they pass, or maybe an overweight man anyway passes this kind of sexy young girl, and immediately you kind of draw up and kind of, you know, try and, you know, you do that kind of preening of yourself. And you see people do that sometimes. If you catch them unawares, then you see them do that. I love not having to do that. I love not having to, I mean, ideally, I guess one wouldn't worry about that, but I love the freedom of not having to care. I love that, actually. I find it so freeing. I find it very, very freeing, that sort of having to be, be someone, or sort of look like something. Yeah. Just to be sort of completely more than anonymous, you know. So I love that. I particularly enjoy that freedom. So I think there's a freedom from it. And I think also there's a sort of freedom to respond that I find on solitary retreats. I think you probably, anybody who's been on any retreat, a solitary retreat or not, will find that the response to nature increases, well, quite dramatically sometimes. I find that happens even more on solitary retreat, and I think it's almost my kindredship with nature increases on solitary retreat. I love, like, just talking to all the little animals and so on, the sheep and the little shrews and mice, you know, and I feel much more, I don't know, just affectionate and just much more, I don't know, just kindred, actually, with these creatures. You know, I feel like a fellow creature with these creatures very strongly. I feel often on retreats one dreams more. I find I dream more on retreats. On solitary retreat, I find that happens even more, and also on solitary retreat, you can let your dreams, sometimes this happens, you get a little run of dreams that actually start to teach you or direct you. And because you're on solitary retreat and you've got your own program in a way, you can respond to that. So I love that. So it doesn't always happen, and you can't legislate for it or make it happen. But on this solitary retreat I was just back from, I think in the first... I have even been the first night. I had a dream when I was in some sort of church, like in like Italy or some one of these medieval churches I was in, and there was a priest on the altar, and everybody was chanting, and they were chanting homage to the Buddha. So they were just chanting that over and over again, homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Just like that, over and over, people were chanting, and I was chanting. And at some point, all the candles on the altar blew out, and I thought, oh, the candles have blown out. Should I light them? And then I thought, no, you don't have to do anything. All you have to do is sit in this atmosphere that this chant has created. So that was in my dream. And then I woke up and was meditating first thing, and I thought, I can just carry on with this chanting and sitting in the atmosphere of the chant. And so I carried that on for the whole of the retreat, so that became part of my daily ritual. Was just to sort of, I almost felt like joining in with this chant rather than chanting it. That's what it felt like in the dream. And it continued to feel like that. So I thought, oh yeah, that's what the dreams tell me. And then just sit in this atmosphere. So it's lovely being able to do that. And you can do it because, you know, well, you do anything you want, you know, really. No one's ever going to know or see you. So you can do that. So I love that. So there's that kind of response. And also, well, I find reading I do take poetry usually on retreat, and I love that. I've been able to had Elizabeth Bishop this time, and just to delve more deeply into a single poet, I just find I just become much more receptive. And then I just became more receptive. I was writing some poetry, and just at one point, just one day, it was the day I was crying actually, I had that experience that doesn't come very often. I was writing this poem. It's got quite a complicated form. It's called A Villanelle anyway. It's got a very particular pattern of rhymes and stress and meter and everything. So usually, in my experience, to write something like that, you'd have to, you know, sit down and work really hard and try and get all the rhymes and get all the syllables and everything and the repetition. And on this day, I was just sitting on the sofa for lots of the day, just kind of tears were running down my face. I was kind of sad. It wasn't a horrible, painful experience. Tears were running down my face. And I had this pen and paper beside me, and it was like every now and then I just reach down. It was almost like I was reaching inside myself and plucking something up, and through my tears kind of writing a line. Oh, and then this thing was written, and it was all in the thing, you know. And it just sort of happened a line at a time. I'd just be like, oh yeah. And then it just sort of wrote down. So that's, I mean, you can't legislate for something like that. It might never happen again in my whole life. But again, how lovely to have the chance to be able to just respond, you know. So there's some of the reasons why. I just want to say another little bit about why before I see if there's any questions. A sort of even deeper reason of why go on solitary. I remember one order member went on a 3-year solitary retreat. And I think within that they were having some guidance and teachers. A couple of them went. And he said at the beginning of that, the reason to go on solitary retreat is to come back. That's the reason to go on any retreat, actually, is to come back. You're not going on a solitary retreat to cut yourself off. You're going to come back. So I think Sangharajita said, or it might not even have been him, that you can only be a friend to the extent you can be alone. So it's like you're being alone in order to be a better friend, yeah? Even if you did go and live in a cave like Milarepa, your practice is essentially about human relationship. So you go to come back. It makes sense, doesn't it, that the more you can be alone, the more you can truly be with someone else, because you're not looking for them to, you know, be on that end of the phone to assuage, you know, because you can't quite manage at the moment, you know. Not that there's anything wrong with that from time to time as well, but, you know, the more you can, the more self-reliant you can be, the more free you are to just be there for that other person, whatever they need or want. So, okay, so that's a little bit about, well, the practice of solitary retreats, what a solitary retreat might be. It might look like something really different to someone else. The tradition of that, in the Buddhist tradition, but also in our Triratna tradition, why you might do it, why you might do it, and how you might do it. So I'm going to stop there. What we're going to do is we've got about maybe just under 15 minutes if there's any questions or discussion. And then we're going to end with a song of Milarepa that Diabhadra is going to sing, another different one, and some just sitting. So I want to make sure we've got time for that before the end. Is there any questions, first of all? Yes.
How tightly did you schedule your time or the repetition of certain activities, like in a day or a week, or if it was 2 weeks, did you think?
Yeah.
Did you think about there being a 1 week has passed, or, you know, how did that?
Yes, that's a good, okay, so that's a few questions almost in there. I think 2 weeks, I did think that. I think that's the advantage of going for longer. Any longer, what I like about longer retreats is it's harder to think of the end of the beginning. I think 2 weeks is still short enough that you do think, oh yeah, I've only got four bananas left or something. You know. So, and I think that you can see the end of it. I think that's a bit of a disadvantage, the shorter it is in some ways, that I was away. I found it hard to forget the end. And different ones, I've done very different things schedule-wise. Sometimes, well, the only ones actually, I completely put away my watch or clock and just allowed my natural rhythm to dictate. This time I did something quite different. I deliberately, just for all sorts of different personal reasons, had quite a strong schedule of meditation, quite a timetable. Yeah, so I had quite a timetable this time. I had sort of thought about it before and thought what would sort of suit me. But, you know, there's anything in between. So again, one's judging it for oneself in a way. I think the ideal thing to do is maybe tune in with yourself before you go and think, oh, what might I need for this? And maybe then assess it in the middle, think, is this working? I did have a bit of a reassessment in the middle. What I found was, as time went on, I just got more and more content not to do anything at all. I think there's two kinds of doing nothing. I think there's a kind of doing nothing as a practice, a bit like we do just sitting, where you're kind of, you're not quite into it yet, so you think, okay, I'm deliberately going to make time just unscheduled for nothing. So at the beginning, I did that as a practice. But then as time went on, I just moved into, just felt contented not to do anything, which was a bit different than doing nothing. I just felt contented. I didn't feel any, I just thought, I could just sit here. I don't really feel I need to do anything, actually. I'm just perfectly happy just sitting here. So that happened more as time went on. So then I definitely, when that happened, I just allowed it to happen. It wouldn't have felt right to interrupt that. And then after a while, somehow you find yourself doing something. Yeah. But yeah, that answer is probably as different as people, and it's different as the circumstances you find yourself. Was there another one here? Does somebody else or for Brian? Yes, Brian. Okay.
What I'm excited about, interested by, is do you ever take some of those experiences and retreat them and take them home so you have effectively sort of retreat surrounded by people? In that, for example, you could decide that for a week you're not going to bother washing, makeup, or just be scrubbing, just be yourself.
Yeah.
It's hard because obviously you've got the extra thing of people noticing. I'm often happiest when I'm completely scruffy, when I was writing, I used to write a lot.
Yeah.
I noticed that I'd go out the house wearing the most ridiculous clothes, swimming trunks, and some horrible top, a sparsely low cut, and showing far too much chest hair. But it wouldn't bother me. I'd be very, very happy.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't care what people think.
Yeah.
And then I would look in the mirror and think, oh my God, you look old, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm out of shape.
Yeah.
So do you ever bring would you bring some of those solitary things into your daily life for a little bit?
I hope so. I'm just not feeling self-conscious about, did I brush my hair tonight? Well, in a way, you're doing quite a good advert for our urban retreat, because it has a bit true. That's exactly what we're trying to do on the urban retreat, is bringing things from both from solitary retreats but and collective retreats into our life. I mean, it happens on, it's interesting on the ordination retreats. People often dress very simply, for example. So it might not be so much being scruffy or dirty or something, but just, decide to wear all one colour or something like that. So, one could bring... I think it is interesting to notice the effects, isn't it, of feeling, just less self-conscious, more free. I hope I do. I hope I bring that sort of attitude back. I suppose it's what you're trying to bring back is the principle. I mean, it might not be practical. You know, you might have a job where you have to look neat or something like that, but it's almost what I hope is perhaps, I suppose there's where something that's just practical turns into something a bit neurotic. So hopefully solitary retreats can help you let go of the neurotic bit, bits of one's behaviour in all sorts of different ways, you know. But I think that particularly how we look to people and how we're sort of wanting to be reflected back, it's just quite interesting when there actually aren't any people to do that, what kind of happens to us.
I'm really interested in the Qigong retreats to come back.
I was curious
about if you know, like, what are some of the effects that you notice after you come back from solitary, particularly if you find that it's a bit different maybe from other, you know, Qigong retreats with other people.
It's funny, I was thinking someone's going to ask me that, and I thought, I think it's harder to notice yourself. I think other people hopefully might notice. Like, I can definitely notice when other people have been on retreat and on solitary retreat. Mm-hmm. It probably is just some of these things, like more responsiveness, more just connectedness, It's interesting to see what's the difference. I don't know if I would, from another person, I don't know if I'd definitely be able to tell if they'd been on a solitary retreat or not a solitary retreat, to be honest. So what are the different effects? I definitely know that, that's an interesting question. It is sometimes hard, because I suppose because to yourself it just feels a bit sort of ordinary, you know, and natural. It's hard to know, and maybe what you notice is when they start to fade, you know. Sometimes I notice that, I notice the effects of any retreat fading, and that can be a bit painful sometimes, But it sounds like that quite captures you, that idea of...
Mm.
Is that because you see it's not about cutting yourself off from
connection? I think in general, in kind of practice, I feel like there's an interesting question or a bit of a tension between this idea of kind of going within and working on your mind, but then also being out there in the world and doing things. Doing both of those things and not prioritising one over the other.
It is a tension, I think, and I think that's the right word for it. And I think we've talked in this class before about what Bhante says about that, that tension is the art is to increase the tension, not to try and collapse the tension, but increase it, and out of that something new will bloom. Mm-hmm. So you up the ante of both. You do more going in and more retreats and more activity. You know, so you do more of both. You focus... might not even be literally the truth, but that inward aspect, you meditate more and you act altruistically more. So you increase the tension, and you let it rub, and then it's almost like a spark. I quite like that image of sticks rubbing, the spark will come from increasing both. So Ellen, then I'll come back to, so we've got 1, 2, 3. Yes, Ella?
What would you say then is the difference between solitude and loneliness?
Interesting, isn't it? Well, I suppose they don't... Well, I was going to say that one can be in solitude and not feel lonely. Also, vice versa, you can be not in solitude and feel lonely. Maybe, and also it's interesting because loneliness is often talked about as a negative thing and a painful thing. But I guess on a solitary retreat, perhaps you're deliberately trying to confront that loneliness rather than it being something that happens to you. You're actually trying to, you're deliberately going into a situation that might bring it on to see how you can respond to that and learn to work creatively with it. But it doesn't mean necessarily making it go away. Maybe it's, I know what it is. I suppose it's like, I'm trying to remember what Sarvananda says in his book, because obviously that's his topic. But it's like learning not to fear loneliness. Maybe that's it. I'm just speaking off the top of my head here. But learning, it's not, I suppose something like loneliness as sadness, they aren't negative emotions. They might be painful feelings, but they're not negative. We often think of them as negative. So we can learn to be with them, befriend them, really. And I think a solitary retreat can give us a chance, perhaps give us more conditions to do that. At the same time, I wouldn't recommend I know you've been on solitary retreats earlier, but I wouldn't recommend someone for the first time doing like a month solitary retreat, because they might get very lonely or fearful and not know how to handle it. You know, my first solitary retreat was 3 days, for example, in not a very secluded place at all. A bit like, you know, other retreats, you know, you might recommend doing a week's retreat first.
Because from my experience, I feel loneliness a lot. Uh-huh. I find it very painful in my everyday life. But yet when I went on a solitary retreat, I didn't feel lonely.
It's
really strange. I can't quite figure out why that was.
Okay.
But when I am in the world, surrounded by people, with so many people in my life, I have a very strong sense of a painful loneliness.
So that's, well, that feels like it's a real cutting edge to investigate then, isn't it? For yourself or for anybody who feels that. You know, probably I can't tell you the answer to that. It's more of something like an experience. You know, for, you could investigate, oh, what is this loneliness I feel when I'm with other people? Almost, how do I feel it? You know, where do I feel it physically? You know, almost try and explore it. Even though it's painful and our instinct is to try and assuage it, just try and gently explore that feeling of loneliness. And, you know, rejoice that you can feel, when you are on your own, feel not lonely. Okay, I'll just have these last two, I think. So where were we? Yes.
I was wondering what was your relationship with the food? Because all this kind of daily rituals, you were living kind of apart, like the devotion and stuff. Did you eat like once, twice?
Or
did you just leave it? Because when we are on our own, we just sometimes don't really cook for ourselves.
Yes. Well, no, I quite like food, so there was no danger. So, I quite an interest in that story of ours. What I did find is I really enjoyed both cooking and eating. I ate really slowly. I did a little ritual of when I've had the food on my plate, I just sort of took a few mindful breaths and sort of just said to myself what the food was. So I said, oh, that's, I don't know, that's coconut and bean stew, you know. So I said, and then I very, very slowly and really enjoyably ate it. And then what happened is the first thing I did when I came out of ended up by a series of coincidence, somebody gave me a lift, blah, blah. I ended up at this really nice cafe that I hadn't expected to be at. And I had an hour there. And first of all, I was really excited because I thought, oh, they've all these brilliant things. And I ordered this lunch and I was thinking, this is delicious. But I couldn't eat it fast and I thought, I'm not going to have time for a cake. And that became painful. And I thought, this is ridiculous. A minute ago, you didn't even know you were going to be here. You're eating this delicious lunch. But it's painful because you won't have time. I had a bus to catch. You won't have time for the cake. So I just thought that was, anyway, just kind of, here I am, of feeling a self-induced pain. I don't know. So, and when I, on the solitary, I didn't have that at all because I was just had all the time in the world. And it's the only sort of sense pleasure of the day, really. So I just thought, well, I'm going to enjoy it, you know. So we're not the only, you know, particular of that kind, yeah. So, yeah, so I really enjoyed mindfully eating. It was very, very enjoyable, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so last one, yeah. I would just...
I'm ready to say something.
Okay, did you have a laugh?
If I may, I'm just very interested. I don't know how remote places you search or find, but I'm interested how you stay safe and how you deal with fear if that comes.
Yeah. Well, strangely enough, I don't seem to have fear in remote places. Some people do. I think I'm perhaps, but so far I don't. And objectively, I think there was nothing to fear. It took me like hours to get. I thought nobody's going to come all this way, you know, and I'll walk miles and row across lochs just to get me, you know. There was nothing. There was no one. So I can be quite rational like that. I know that wouldn't be the case with everyone, but I didn't feel that. I was not afraid in that kind of way. I was a little bit, I thought, oh, if something happens, I'll be in trouble, like I twist my ankle or something, but I'm sure it'll work it out. Whereas other people might be too fearful for them, so then I say, don't go in a remote place. If being remote makes you so frightened, one would be overwhelmed, I say, it's like learning. Knowing yourself well enough to know, well, that would just overwhelm me. There's no point in doing that. You know, I've known people that did a solitary retreat in, you know, a hut in someone's garden, for example, where they were, or a caravan in someone's garden, where they knew there was someone on hand. If they had that, so I suppose it just depends on one's own temperament. That wouldn't be fear that would get me, you know. It might be other things, but it wouldn't be fear. So it's definitely, yeah. I can't think that it was unsafe where I was, because yeah, as I say, it was so far away. There was, you know, I'm sure objectively one's probably more at risk in the city, but I know those fears can come, you know. But yeah, if you thought that was going to happen, I'd say choose somewhere. Well, like when we get Vajrasana up and running again, the solitary retreat, little hunts at the retreat centre. You know, most retreat centres, for example. Yeah, maybe I should end by saying a few practical things. If people did want to go on solitary retreat, a good option for the first time is pick somewhere that's attached to a retreat centre, because it's all set up. They'll usually give you your food. And it will, you know, there'll be people on hand if you feel in any way anxious or nervous. So even though Vajrasana is closed, our other retreat centres, Rivendell, Tara Loka for women, Gukhi Loka for men, Dharma Kosha, you know, loads of retreat centres have got like a little chalet attached that you can do a solitary retreat. Or there's other, you know, there's a list on our website of a few tried and tested little huts that people have been to. Or else, you know, if you want to go further afield, it is quite hard to get. The place is really isolated, actually. Sometimes I'd be more afraid of running into someone, you know. It can be quite, you know, in Britain especially, very, very few isolated places left, to be honest. There's always so... If anyone knows of any, I did think I might start a little list of where in the most isolated places people go for people who do like that. But yeah, if anybody wanted to try it, I'd recommend going to somewhere attached to a retreat centre, or there's a place, Dharma Loka, that's on our website, or a few other places that are set up for solitary retreats, like a shrine there, meditation cushions. The atmosphere of people always having meditated there. I really recommend it as a practice, even just for a weekend or a couple of days to begin with, and then, yeah, who knows, you might even be like Nagaraj to go on 9 months in the future. You can read about her little interview just before she went and what she hopes to gain from that. Lots of us, lots of the order members and mitras regularly go on 1 or 2 weeks retreat anyway, and he's just about to go up next week, yeah. Good, so let's finish with just 5 minutes just sitting and hearing one of Milarepa's songs. So let me just sit for a moment. Ready, we'll hear the song, and then after a few moments,
obeyance to you, my Guru. I met you through having accumulated great merits, and now stay at the place you prophesied. This is a delightful place, a place of hills and forests, in the mountain meadows. Flowers bloom, in the woods dance the swaying trees. For monkeys it is a playground, birds sing tunefully, bees fly and buzz. And from day until night, the rainbows come and go. In summer and winter falls the sweet rain, and mist and fog roll up in fall and spring. At such a pleasant place, in solitude, I, Milarepa, happily abide, meditating upon the void illuminating mind. O happy are the myriad manifestations, the more ups and downs, the more joy I feel. Happy is the body with no sinful karma. Happy indeed are the countless confusions. The greater the fear, the greater the happiness I feel. Oh, happy is the death of sensations and passions. The greater the distress and passions, the more can one be blithe and gay. What happiness to feel no ailment or illness. What happiness to feel that joy and suffering are all one. What happiness to play in bodily movement with the power aroused by yoga, to jump and run, to dance and leap is more joyful still. What happiness to sing the victorious song! What happiness to chant and hum! More joyful still to talk and loudly sing! Happy is the mind, powerful and confident, steeped in the realm of totality. The most extreme happiness is the self-emanation of self-power. Happy are the myriad forms, the myriad revelations, as a welcoming gift to my faithful pupils, I sing of yogic happiness.